Right, so now before I start pretending that I know anything about the ORSA process, I'll introduce you to Klaas van Wyk de Vries from Sanlam and Karen Lowe from Old Mutual, which makes me think that, you know, you might have thought that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and now you're sticking together on this ORSA process. So I'm not going to say anything else. I'm not sure who's going to talk first, but as I understand, they would like to have this to be an interactive process, so please raise your hand and stop them if you have any questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex. I actually just landed from Cape Town 2 hours ago, so if I look like I don't know where I am, I don't. But anyway, so what does Google say about the ORSA? So first thing, when I don't know what a topic means, and when I started to get involved in Solvency 2, I Googled the ORSA, and this is the first hit I got. The Orbit Reconstruction Simulation and Analysis. That is actually a software tool that's way cooler than Prophet or Moses, because it analyzes the stuff in the orbit of the Earth, like satellites and meteorites, etc. So that was the first hit I got. The second hit I got was, it's a place in Sweden somewhere. So that's Sweden. That's the red bit there, and that's where also in Sweden is. So I didn't know that. The third hit I got was, funny enough, not IOPA's description of the ORSA, but the one by the Association of British Insurers. So that's what I'll be talking to you about, is the ORSA as defined by Solvency II or SAM. So just to put it into a little bit of perspective first, the own risk insolvency assessment is part of Pillar 2 of SAM and of Solvency 2. So it's got to do with the risk management, the system of governance. Although saying that, there is a very quantitative component to the ORSA that we'll see as we go through the presentation. Okay, so I thought the best way of introducing the ORSA was actually just to tell you a little bit about the principles and the building blocks underlying the ORSA as the ORSA concept. Start off with that, and then talk a bit about how those building blocks translated into the own risk insolvency assessment requirements that you are likely to see in the new insurance law. And then talk a little bit about the next steps that the task group, the FSB task group, will undertake. Then two questions I usually get from most of the people I speak to on the ORSA is, what is the ORSA process? How do we go about implementing an ORSA process for our business? And the second question is, how long should the ORSA report be? I really don't know how long the ORSA report should be, but I will tell you a little bit about what I think should go into ORSA report. And then lastly, I'll end off with a few observations as to where European companies is with the ORSA and in their Solvency II regime. As I said, the ORSA is part of Pillar 2, and the ORSA is defined as the entirety of processes and procedures to identify, assess, monitor, manage, and report risk, and determine the own funds necessary to ensure that the overall solvency needs are met at all times and are sufficient to meet the business strategy. That's a mouthful. It's quite a big definition. But I think if we unpack it, there are basically three key components to this definition. It's risk, it's capital management, and it's the business, the management of the business. So first of all, let me start off by, and Alex and I talked about this briefly before the session, by iterating that the ORSA is not a report. The output of the ORSA results in a ORSA report, but the own risk insolvency assessment is an assessment. It's not a report as such. It's an assessment that pulls together the risk management processes, such as risk appetite setting, monitoring of risk limits, the capital management processes, such as the monitoring of return on capital, capital allocation decisions, and the business processes. Okay. Now, That is a mouthful, and perhaps it would be helpful if I just talk a little bit about the building blocks of the ORSA, the building blocks being value, risk, and capital, and then describe the relationship between those three building blocks. First of all, value. Insurance companies, any company for that matter, will look to increase value to its stakeholders, stakeholders being the public, shareholders, the employees, policyholders, etc., by optimizing return on capital. That needs to be done within a certain set of risk parameters to ensure that the company don't expose itself to unnecessary risk, and companies would be looking to optimize risk-taking, again, to increase value. So that describes those two legs of the triangle. The relationship between capital and risk is quite a simple one, in that insurers are taking risk on the one side, market risk, credit risk, underwriting risk, whatnot. They need to hold enough capital to make good when those risks materialize, so to ensure solvency. And that describes that relationship there at the bottom. Okay, so it was really against this backdrop that we in the task group created or came up with the ORSA requirements. Two key questions that the ORSA need to answer. Actually, three. Yes, three. The first question is, can we afford our business plan? So as a company, do we hold enough capital to mitigate against the risks? Bearing in mind not all risks can be mitigated through holding capital, over our business planning period. So that's the first question. Can we afford our business plan? The second and third questions are we exposed to the right risks? So has the board decided, actually, was there a conversation at board level around what risks do we want to be exposed to? And are we exposed to the right levels of those risks? So then it's quite important that the senior management and the board takes ownership of this process. And you'll see when I talk about the proposed regulatory requirements of the ORSA that that is actually one of the first concepts. So in performing the ORSA, management should really take responsibility for considering the triangle, value, capital, and risk, in the context of the business strategy. Okay, so I think that's the ORSA in terms of the conceptual thinking behind it. So how did these building blocks now manifest in proposals for primary and subordinated legislation? So what I've done is I've just summarized the proposed requirements in four categories, being governance, strategic nature of the ORSA, valuation basis, and compliance. I'm not sure, Alex, are these slide decks usually available afterwards? Okay. So I've also attached as appendices the more detailed requirements. So the specific requirements of position paper 34, which is the position paper issued by the ORSA and USDESC task group on the ORSA. Okay, so governance. Please, if you have any questions, just stop me and raise your hand. We do have a roving mic. So regarding governance, the ultimate responsibility and accountability of the own risk insolvency assessment lies with the board. What do they need to do? They need to approve the ORSA, and they need to challenge the solvency capital requirement, the SCR, in light of the ORSA output. They also need to be evidenced appropriately. There are documentation requirements. The documentation requirements will probably not make it into primary or secondary legislation. These will most likely be included in other guidance. Those documentation requirements are... that's not my phone interfering. Documentation requirements are, you need an ORSA policy. Needs to be a record of the ORSA process. Internal management information dealing with risk and capital, or the internal ORSA report. And then the ultimate output is the ORSA report to the regulator. To keep the accountants and the auditors in in work. There's a requirement for independent assessment. No, that's not really why, but there's a requirement for independent assessment on the ORSA report, focused on ultimately compliance with the ORSA policy and compliance with the Act. Bearing in mind, this is an independent review, not necessarily an external external review. So, to the extent that that internal audit or risk management do have knowledge and skills to evaluate the ORSA process, then companies can do it internally. Does not necessarily have to go external. Okay. Then, in terms of the strategic nature of the ORSA is a forward-looking tool. It's a forward-looking assessment of risk and capital. I don't know who was at the FSB the SAM update. Yeah, for those who were there, the slide that Ian put up, where he put SCR in the middle. So Ian had had a very cool slide up where he explained the calculation of the ORSA capital, starting with the SCR in the middle, the solvency capital requirement, the regulatory capital requirement, building that out for risks that companies face or companies think they face that are not included in the calibration of the SCR, and then ultimately building it out again to allow for a buffer, which is in effect the company's risk appetite. And then he described that as the ORSA capital today, and then he had three of those on, say, T0, T1, T2, T3, so projecting it forward. So it needs to be a forward projection over the business planning horizon. Okay, also need to include stress and scenario testing. So I'm not an actuary, so I'm not going to pretend that I know what I'm talking about when I say the word stress and scenario testing. So I'm not going to talk about it anymore. There needs to be a feedback loop between the ORSA, the outcome of the ORSA, and the business planning processes. As you'll see later, there's a requirement to embed. Well, actually, not later, it's on the slide. There's a requirement to embed risk and capital management in the business. Now, if that's embedded, then there needs to be a feedback loop from the ORSA output back into your business planning processes. And lastly, there also needs to be an assessment of all material risk, current and in the future. Okay, then regarding the evaluation basis, there also is a quantitative assessment of required capital. The valuation basis does need to be complex. For example, at Sanlam, we are not using internal model. We're using the standard formula. So where a company is using the standard formula, it can actually follow the approach that I described earlier, starting with the SCR, bearing in mind that the SCR calculation is already a risk-based quantification of capital, 1 in 200, yeah. Whatever valuation basis the companies use, it needs to keep the auditors happy. So it needs to ensure that the system of financial reporting hangs together, and it must be able to reconcile the one valuation basis to the other. So be able to reconcile from IFRS to regulatory SAM basis to the economic basis. Okay. Then lastly, there are some specific compliance requirements, bearing in mind that the requirement from a Pillar 1 side to comply with the SCR and be solvent is a continuous requirement. It's not a point-in-time requirement. The requirements that relate to the technical provisions is also continuous requirements. It's not a point-in-time requirement. They also need to demonstrate how a company is solvent on a continuous basis. Now, this does not necessarily mean that companies have to have real-time capital calculation capabilities in place. It is, however, one of those areas that, and I hate to say the word because I don't, I think the SAM structure is still figuring out what it means, but it's one of those areas where we need to apply proportionality to say that if you're a smaller company with a less complex and risky book, it's okay to calculate your capital once a quarter or twice a year. Don't necessarily have to have monthly or more frequent calculation capabilities in place. The ORSA needs to be performed on a going concern basis. Now that means if you are projecting your business to be a going concern in the future, you need to do your ORSA on a similar basis. And I guess if you're not projecting to be a going concern, then you'll be having very intimate discussions with the regulator, and the regulator will tell you exactly how to do your ORSA. The last requirement is one about reporting. I'll speak about the ORSA report a little bit later. But there is a solo reporting requirement, which basically means that if you hold a life license and is a legal entity, you need to do an ORSA. There's also a requirement for groups, insurance groups, to perform ORSAs. Now the task group did propose a waiver in this area, in the sense that if your solo company is part of a group and the group ORSA include the detailed capital and risk assessment of the solo company, then you can ask the FSB for a waiver not to submit the solo ORSA, but only submit the group ORSA. Okay, that was a very quick overview of the requirements that you are likely to see in the primary and secondary legislation. Maybe just to draw your attention to what's out there in terms of primary and secondary legislation at the moment. Position paper 34 is the position paper on the ORSA. That has been approved as a final position paper by STEAKO and is out on the FSB website for consultation. So please have a look at it. Please comment back to my task group. We do need those comments. And then draft 2, I think. Yeah, it's draft 2 of the proposed the new insurance bill is out. And the ORSA is in Article 27. Okay, so what else is my task group going to do over the next couple of months? Earlier the year, IOPA issued the consultation paper, which is consultation paper 008, which is quite a detailed consultation paper on the ORSA. It is not part of the legislation, so it's not level 1 or level 2 text. It's level 3 guidance. So it will be issued to member states as guidance. Now we're using that to build our further guidance that we will issue to the insurance industry from a task group's point of view. So we're looking at about 22 principles, including more detail on proportionality, documentation, the forward-looking nature of the ORSA, etc., etc. Okay, so I guess I've now talked about the regulatory side of the ORSA, and perhaps before I take my regulatory hat off and put my business hat on, are there any questions, comments at this stage? Yes.
I'm just considering the practical challenges of supervising the ORSA as a process rather than just the supervisor reading the report. How will that happen? I mean, don't you foresee any challenges there?
I'm not working for the FSB, but I can give you some of my experiences in Europe around what the FSA is doing. From the companies that I did speak to in Europe, the FSA is actually diving down into the next level of detail. So they are looking at companies' processes. They are getting internal audit in companies to review those processes. Or if the companies don't have necessarily skills in internal audit, they do actually they did indicate that they will ask for third parties to look at it. The FSA is really serious about this. As I said, I'm not working for the regulator, but I can't see that the FSB will be any less serious about it. And I guess with Twin Peaks coming in, where you'll have more of a kind of a larger staff base, or the Reserve Bank will be will provide a platform for much much bigger staff base for the FSP. But yeah, I think staffing is probably an issue with the regulator as it stands at the moment. Sure, you said you're going to ask controversial questions, not like this. Okay, good. Okay, then, what do insurers need? Two questions that I get is, how do we go about developing the ORSA process? Think back to the definition of the ORSA. The ORSA is a process of risk management, capital management, and business planning. That's the first question that I get. I'll speak about that in the next slide. Senior management and board's understanding of the interaction between value, risk, and capital. Now, I think that's crucial. But I also think that for larger companies, for companies who've been around for a while, companies who do have a matured risk management framework, this is probably not an issue. Smaller companies, younger companies who do find the requirements of Pillar 2 challenging, may require some training at board and senior manager level. So yeah, let's move on to the ORSA process. So for my sins, I'm the business architect for our SAM program at Sanlam. And this is just kind of the way that I foresee us developing the ORSA process. First of all, I don't think that once an ORSA process is developed and you walk away from your SAM project and you have a standalone ORSA process similar to an underwriting process or similar to a reporting process, I don't think your SAM program would have been successful, because I don't think the ORSA process is a standalone process. I think it's a bit of each business process, and those bits are risk identification, risk measurement, quantification of risk and capital, and the analysis of the risk impact on solvency. So how are we going about it? We are actually taking our value chain functions, such as product development, business planning, capital management, and asking these four questions in each of those functions. So for my business planning function, how does my function identify risk? Are there workshops? Are there kind of wall sessions led by risk management or facilitated by risk management? How's my risk measured? So what are the measurements used in my risk appetite statement? For example, on volatility, future earnings volatility. From a business planning point of view, to what extent are you willing to deal with future earnings volatility? Quantification, how are risks and how is the capital quantified in our business planning process? Over 3 years, to what extent are year one a very accurate projection versus year two, three, and four maybe not so accurate? This is where the actuarial function do actually play quite a key role. How's the risk impact on solvency assessed in our business planning function? This is where our finance department play a key role. So finance put together risk MI, link it to capital, and doing the analysis and doing the comments on those MI pieces and sending it out to the business. So that's kind of in a nutshell how I think companies should actually go about looking at embedding the ORSA in their business. Yes, there will be a standalone process for doing the ORSA report. But again, when we started to unpack the ORSA report, we found that there's actually very little additional information that we can give our board that they don't get already on risk and capital management. Okay, so yes, roving mic.
All right, let's try this. What is the difference, and sorry if I'm naive here, but what's the difference between measurement and quantification? Why the need to split the two? And is there not a feedback loop somewhere here where you have to make a decision, or is that still coming?
Okay, I don't understand your second question. I'll What decision do you mean?
So maybe a different in our actual control cycle, we have the identification, the assessment, and then the management of risk. And I see your thinking, but I don't see the management side, and I see a duplicate measurement. Maybe just explain to us why.
Okay, sure. Okay. So on the risk measurement side, it's basically how do I want to measure my risk? It's deciding on the metrics. So it's not necessarily the detailed quantification of it. It's what's the metric, deciding on the metric. Is that metric still relevant given my risk profile? Am I still worried about earnings volatility, or am I now more worried about something else? So that's the risk measurement, the quantification that's running the numbers through the model. Yes, absolutely right. You are right. There is a decision, and that is where the analysis of the risk impact on solvency. You know, that's almost where I see that decision. In terms of how the ORSA is used in the product, for example, if you think about a business decision in a product development process, do I go for this product? Yes or no? Or how much capital will this product take up? The ORSA is simply informing that process. So you know, I didn't put a specific separate decision on my model. Happy? Cool. Any more questions? Let me just finish up on this slide by saying that the outcome of the ORSA process is a comprehensive and forward-looking assessment of the risk profile, together with plans to maintain solvency based on various scenarios. Okay, documentation. Alex asked me why I left EY. I used to be an auditor there. And I think this is a reality of it. Sam is actually asking for more documentation. There's a saying in the industry, if it's not documented, it's not done. So I get the question, what should be in the ORSA report? So first of all, and I've said this in front of the FSB, and they didn't say anything back to me, so I hope we're going for this. There's no plans to prescribe a standard ORSA report template. So companies will be expected to do the ORSA report on their own templates, and it needs to be aligned with how the business is managed. What should go in there? I think there's obviously going to be a quantitative and a qualitative side to the ORSA. On the quantitative side, solvency as at the reporting date, regulatory solvency and economic solvency, if you're using a different reporting basis. Forward-looking view of solvency, so those two numbers, the regulatory solvency, the economic solvency, projected over the business planning period. The link between risk and capital, which can usually be found in your risk appetite statement, your risk, which filters down to risk tolerances, the actual measurement of those tolerances. And then stress and scenario testing. So you think back about the business planning process. Companies usually don't do business planning just on a base case scenario. There's usually some alternative scenarios. So there's a requirement for the ORSA to be performed over specific business scenarios, together with some stress testing to test the robustness and the resilience of solvency. And there's a specific requirement to include reverse stress testing in the stress testing part of the ORSA. Okay, on the qualitative side, there's obviously going to be the static risk type of information that describe the system of risk management, the system of governance, such as policies, frameworks, management actions, etc. And then there's what I like to call the fluid type of risk information, which are those qualitative bits and pieces that changes from year in and year out. So risk appetite, change in risk profile, how risks are managed, etc. If I'm rambling through this, then It is because I've given you in the appendices, look like this, a very nice outline of something that you can use as a starting point for doing your OSA report. Don't take this as the start and end all. I've taken this from a very good document issued by the Dutch Insurance Association, which I'll refer to again later. Okay. I think initially the task group struggled a bit with when the OSA report should be done, because obviously it makes sense to run a set of numbers at the year end to coincide with your regulatory numbers and IFRS numbers. But then, you know, the debate came up, so if the OSA is a management tool, shouldn't we actually do our detailed OSA calculations at the time we do our business planning? That may be at a different date. So it's something for companies to consider. Okay, so where does Europe stand with the OSA? And with OSA? I think specifically the UK, bearing in mind that they did have a ICA regime, capital regime in place, which is also a regime that stresses the balance sheet to calculate the capital number. For some years now, the gap for them to close is probably less than for South African companies that didn't necessarily have that. Many insurers in Europe is actually struggling with OSA. Many large insurers has actually commented to me and said that the boards have pushed back on the OSA report and asked, so what's new? So give us new information. So the OSA is, the development of the OSA at those companies are iterative processes. And they didn't all get it right the first time. Think about how the European companies are thinking about the OSA as a process. It's pretty much the same as I described earlier. It's embedding risk and capital in each of their business processes. On the OSA report, companies are going almost two ways here. They're using the index and they're creating an OSA report from the index. Some companies are doing that. Other companies are saying, well, we already give our boards good risk and capital management information. We're just going to put a wrapper around it. So that they're developing OSA dashboards, 3 to 5 page dashboards that pull together the risk and capital management information of the business. Okay, and then I think it's fair to say that the European companies have actually graduated OSA 101. So most of the companies have a baseline OSA process and a baseline OSA report in place. They're now looking at the more tricky aspects of the OSA, so building the links between risk and capital, deciding on stress and scenario testing approaches. And then lastly, you know, most companies that I talk to seem to have decided to actually calculate the OSA capital at year end, but they're also struggling with the question, you know, is that the best time to do that, to do it? Okay. So I've already mentioned everything on this slide. Okay, right. This is then a list of the reference material that's out there at the moment. So draft 2 of the primary legislation, Article 27, Position Paper 34, IOPA CP 008, my screen's just doing funny things here. The OSA index I took from this last bullet on the slide, the Dutch Association of Insurers, and the document is called Vision on Own Risk and Solvency Assessment, Good Practices. And then there's a very good publication by Accenture, which is called Unlocking Business Value Through the OSA Implementation. Okay, and with that, that's the end of my talk. I'm happy to take any questions. Not on this, though. On the OSA.
Hi. Just in terms of the timing of the OSA, you said some of the guys are struggling as to whether to do it year-end, business planning. In that slide that you showed with the circle going around and you had business planning and capital management, you emphasized on how important the business planning process was. So I'm just trying to understand why would it not coincide with business planning? If that is the central, you know, theme, almost when I read the CP position paper 34 and the reliance on strategy and developing the risk strategy and the forward-looking concept, why would it not coincide there?
I guess the challenge is a practical one, in that companies, especially medium-sized, smaller companies, not necessarily Sanlam or MMI, because you know their capital calculation is more frequent. But you know, typically those companies, the smaller companies, only run their financial processes at half year and at year end. So you have kind of very detailed information to work with at those dates. So you are able to do a very detailed calculation. You don't necessarily have that at a practical level at other dates. So it's a practical issue.
Yeah, I just had a question on how do you see the ORSA process influencing board composition? We spoke earlier on about the ORSA process being owned by the board, and from a fit and proper perspective, do you see the board composition changing because of the requirements that the ORSA would have on the board to give confidence that they understand what's in the ORSA process? And also, how do you see actuaries then playing a role within the board as NEDs?
Sure, yeah, that's quite a good question. Well, the board need to have the appropriate skills and expertise. It's not only, the board doesn't only need to understand the ORSA, the board also need to understand the regulatory capital. They also need to understand the financial statements, etc. So the board needs to understand some really complex stuff. And in a life insurer, those things are even more complicated. I do think personally, this is now speaking from a personal point of view and not a Sanlam or a FSB view. I do think there is going to be quite a strong role for actuaries on the board to play. You know, if not in a statutory kind of position, and I'm also not sure where the discussions around the appointed actuary, the role of the statutory actuary, is going to end up in. So, sorry, not a very good answer, but I'm probably not the right person to be to answer the question. Question over there.
Thanks. George Marks. Some of you may know me. Old professors don't die. They only lose their faculties. So if I speak somewhat incoherently, you know why. I'd like to react to that question. The hat that I'm wearing here is really as a non-executive director, chairman of the audit committee of a medium-sized life insurer and also member of the audit committee of a fairly large short-term insurer. And your question is absolutely relevant. I'm the only actuary on those two boards in non-executive capacity, and as such I feel pretty exposed. My fellow board members, at each meeting where the ORSA process, SAM, and these kind of things get discussed, say they haven't got the faintest clue what this is about. So, and then I look in my eyes and I'm not much better. I have my CPD and that's about it. So really your question is extremely, extremely relevant. And what I'd like to ask is this whole ORSA process, yes, in theory I vouch for it. It is about calculations, it's about boxes being ticked. But are we doing the right sums and have we got the right boxes to be ticked? And I specifically ask that in relation to two things. The one is that at some stage there was an analysis internationally of failures of life insurers in particular. And if I recollect it properly, bearing in mind loss of faculty, none of those, or very few of those, was really related to inadequate capital in relation to risk being taken. Much of it had to do with rogue CEOs. And I'd also like to ask, the FSB currently gets for each insurer on an annual basis these LT returns and the ST returns. And they get asked the question, what do you as a business see as the top 5, 6, or 7, I can't remember the number, risks? I'd like to ask, to what extent does this whole process address the risks identified by those companies? I suspect it does get assessed, but it does get considered, but not in that proportion. And I'd like to pose the thought that proportionality needs to be considered in relation to those questions that are answered, the data is there by the regulators and this whole process. Last remark from my side, the ORSA process is hugely about processes and management action in the whole business decision process. The flaw that I recognize is still inadequate evaluation assessment of the people and the quality of the people and the role of the people. In one of our board meetings very recently, there was a major risk failure in IT systems. And one of my fellow directors asked, to what extent, having heard the explanations by management, to what extent was this a people problem and to what extent was it a system problem? And the answer was, it was more a people problem than a system problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Those were some very, very relevant thoughts and questions. And actually, I just want to make a comment on your comment on business failures. And you're absolutely right. It's not to do with holding enough capital. It's to do with governance failures, failure of controls, a rogue CEO, a rogue trader, for example. I think, again, they also need to be seen in together with all the other Pillar 2 requirements, which are governance requirements, control requirements, etc. So thank you very much for those thoughts. Any more? Thanks, everybody.
Hi, everyone. My name is Karen Lowe. There are a couple of familiar faces in the crowd. For those of you who know me, I'm very passionate about ORSA, but I've been limited to this topic about trying to explain to you what the benefits are of us going the internal model route, specifically for embedding ORSA, and maybe what some of the additional challenges are because we did that. So I just want to spend a few minutes on giving a little bit of background, just so that you know what the key questions were for us on a Pillar 1 and a Pillar 2 basis, to position it, to see what aspects we were grappling with, and then I'll move on to the benefits and the challenges. So on a Pillar 1 basis view, we had to ask ourselves, why are we going the internal model route? And I think those points there are fairly obvious, but they're quite crucial. So we knew that the standard formula is not going to reflect our risk profile. And for us, using economic capital in the business was very important that it did that, obviously. We're also quite a complex group, so in order to aggregate all these risks together, we wanted to go for a single group model, and made sense to combine that with the internal model application. We already had an existing economic capital calculation embedded in the group, so this would not have been a new concept for management. They already had it as part of the talk at the top, as part of demonstrating when you did, say, an M&A or other business activities, and knew what impact that would have on their performance management. So it was just a new way of calculating that. A complex way, but a new way. And then we had also a relatively well-developed ERM system already there. So we were performing regular risk and control self-assessments, identifying key risk drivers, recording internal risk events, etc. I think the problem was that the last two bullets there weren't interacting well. So although we had most of the capital and most of the risk, the triangle, the interaction wasn't happening. And so when we came to our Pillar 2 question, the question was really, what additional value is this ORSA thing going to add? And so when we were developing our ORSA framework, that was the focus of it. So focusing on what value does risk-based decision-making give to your stakeholders? Okay, so we focused on the link between risk strategy and business strategy, on more granular, more accurate projections of the solvency position over the business plan, trying to look at emerging risks that happen over the business plan given certain key risk decisions, and then really using the ORSA as a communication tool, a technique to demonstrate this risk-based decision-making, and perhaps using it as a mechanism for collecting evidence. So this is what why we tell people they need to demonstrate what they're doing. Okay, so that's the background to it. In terms of benefits, there were two sides to the coin. It was really nice for us to have the regulatory push, and I'll highlight some of the elements for you, why the internal model regulations specific to them were helpful in developing and embedding the ORSA. But there was also this management pool, so the guys, they know that they need to manage minimize the capital number, and they wanted to understand how do you calculate it, what affects it. As part of the internal model training and education, there was greater participation because of this. But also they needed to understand how to apply it as a risk management tool. And I'll just pause there and say we're not there yet. In all aspects, we don't really fully understand yet. And then a slightly different angle that we weren't expecting was from the board's perspective, they were getting all these numbers, all this methodology, all the stats and the everything that they needed to understand. And they were saying, wait, just take a step back and tell us from a scenario perspective the impact on our business. And that's exactly what the ORSA is also asking us to do. So in a way, this influx of internal model documentation, etc., helped us to also take a step back and further embed the ORSA processes. Okay, so I just want to spend a little bit more time on the regulatory side. I guess for the guys on standard formula, these might be helpful places to start looking if you want to improve your framework or if you want to help explain to the guys what they need to do. And as part of the internal model application, you have to pass 7 tests. So to prove that your model is adequate and appropriate, those are the tests that you need to pass. And of the 7, the use test and the validation standards are the most relevant, we found for the developing the ORSA process. So the use test, the regulatory impetus behind it is so that you can demonstrate to the regulator that this model that you're using to calculate regulatory capital is the same model that you're using to make business decisions. That's the reason for the use test. It goes a little bit further if you use it from a ORSA perspective, because it can be a really powerful tool to get the guys thinking about how they actually use the number, the capital number, both for risk management and for communicating exposures about risk. And on the validation standards side, I mean, the purpose of it is to make sure that the model is, good and it keeps being improved. But from an ORSA perspective, there's some key tools, and I'll go through them now, that really help you in developing the ORSA concepts. I won't spend too much time on this. I just wanted to give a little bit of an idea. We went a little bit further, so we could have said, okay, full stop. We can prove that it's the same model. We use our 99.93 for EC and our 99.5, and we don't need to do anything further. But what we actually did was we developed quite a comprehensive framework. We took every possible business process where you could use economic capital to make a decision. Those are listed there. We split those even further, and then we assigned business owners to those processes and tasked them with explaining how they're using this model in decision-making. And we had a whole 4-categoried process of ranking yourself. So you might be on blue or you might be on red. And there were specific requirements on how to progress from one to the other within your specific area. So I mention it because I think it was very helpful in getting the line one guys, the guys are actually in the business making the decisions, to think about capital and how they could apply it. Right, back to the validation standards. So these are the minimum requirements according to the IOPA Level 2 regs. And again, I'll just highlight a couple that are particularly useful for you when you're looking at OSA development. Backtesting. So you have to go back and test this model against the actual outcomes. But it also gives you impetus for OSA feedback loops. So that diagram is really, really easy to draw, but to get it actually happening is very difficult. And my answer, I think, to the guy somewhere around there about actuaries on boards, actually it's the guy sitting in this room, apart from you, who's actually on the board, who needs to be much better at communicating what risk is, how we calculate the risk, how we allow for risk in our models, and we need to be better at understanding the business and what our models really mean. So that's my view as an actuary, still in the upward slant towards a board seat. Sensitivity testing, on the face of it, not very useful for also plausible but extreme threats, but it gave us a starting point for discussing factors to which the business is sensitive to. So it allows you to talk to the CEO for segment X, Y, and Z and say, this is what our model is telling us. Is this true? Is this where your business is sensitive? It was useful from a risk perspective. Stress and scenario testing, again, gave a starting point for wider stress and scenario testing. You'll see later it was also a negative. Reverse stress testing was crucial for OSA. So even though the output from the model was quite technical, it's millions of simulations and you sort of pick a scenario that you think could happen, it's useful as a starting point for the board then to go and say, okay, well now I'll build that out. Tell me, how does that affect my regulator and what the decisions are that they're going to make? Tell me what the impact is on my clients. So use that again as a starting point, but not the end all and the be all. And finally, profit and loss attribution. I've put there helps focus on non-quantifiable risk. We haven't quite gotten there either yet, but the idea is that where you know that you've tested your model, you understand the inputs that you're giving, and you're still getting a big loss in X, Y, Z, it focuses on other areas, for example, a loss due to reputational damage or a broker channel that's gone rogue. So, right. The other side of the coin, the management pool side. So I've pulled together a few examples for you. They're quite high level, but I think they're interesting to see the types of ideas that the OSA process generated in the business. So you can see here, this example is about understanding the risk-return relationship. The size of the blob is about how big that piece of business is in the organization. And then we've plotted a profit measure against a capital measure, very simple. And the diagonal line, if you're above it, it means the pricing in your product is sufficient to carry the capital costs. If you're below it, you haven't priced it correctly for whatever reason. Maybe Solvency II capital is more onerous because of the guarantees that you have that you didn't have on your previous capital basis. So you needed to go and investigate those. And then I guess the point that I'd like to make as part of my remit is that because our capital model, our internal model, was based off our Prophet and Moses models and it's the same mechanism for calculating the VNB, those were apples with apples. So, you know, there's synergy there. So you can go and see, you can investigate the cash flows and you can see what impact that has on the capital. And that's incredibly powerful. Second example was around reinsurance. So trying to weigh up how much you cede versus pricing in the market, so reinsurance rate probably much lower than the one that you would internally be comfortable pricing on versus capital efficiency. And the green bar is the profits that you would cede to the reinsurer, and the blue bar is the capital that you would have saved by passing on the risk. And you can see for product X, it made no sense whatsoever. We were giving away lots more capital than the profits than the capital that we were saving. Product Y, neither here nor there. Product Z, maybe you need to think a bit harder about it. And this is only one side of the coin, right? But that's the whole point, is that you bring in risk and capital decision-making into business decisions. You might decide you still want to go with a reinsurer for other reasons. But it's to give a more full picture. And the last example that I want to give, I know the graph's a little bit small, etc., but This one was about understanding your risk profile and how it's going to move over time. So without our internal model development, we would never have gotten here for this product. A lot of hard work went into simulations and making this picture work. What it shows you is the risk profile for a funeral product. And what you would expect happens in the beginning, in that your equity risk, the red bar is equity risk, is virtually non-existent in the beginning years. In fact, negative. Okay? Negative sterlings. And that if you'd made a stab at it and said that was your risk profile for now, you would have left it at that. This particular product had certain paid-up guarantees, which meant that over the period of time, equity risk actually becomes really important. And when you have a risk strategy that says, I'm trying to minimize equity risk, or I have a limit, and you have a product that you've sold 10 years ago that's going to exceed that, this is useful information to know and understand how to manage it. Right, so the challenges. Some of you might have been at the actuarial convention in Cape Town. A colleague of mine drew this picture, and it is so very true for our business, in that pillar one just completely dominated the last 2 years of SAM development, and it left very little time and resource for pillars two and three. In particular, the internal model development itself, the production of the documentation, the multitude of policies that we've had to develop around internal model governance, validation, documentation standards, etc. Management time and focus. I mean, the board have reviewed all of those policies. They have to. It's part of the requirements, the expectation. They've reviewed all the IMAP documentation, and there's just no more appetite. So after pillar one, you get to pillar two, the real crux of what the board should be looking at in management, and there's no appetite. Significant governance burdens, and in addition to all this internal model governance, there are also requirements. So I've just listed a couple of points, but we needed some forum. Our CRO owns this report, this process, but we need a governance forum to decide on work plans and scenarios and, you know, evaluate the information that comes through. And you could argue it happens at a board level, but actually our organization doesn't work like that. It goes through board risk, and then it goes through board. So there's a lot more work to be done in addition. Then back to stress and scenario testing. Eventually it got to the point where we were so consumed by what the model was telling us that actually we weren't taking a step back and looking at the wider impact of scenarios. And then the group is large, and if you weren't an internal model entity in Old Mutual, you know, there was no focus on your capital calculation or risk process development, etc. And really just because we wanted to standardize these principles across the group, so we borrowed from the internal model, we borrowed from the wider Solvency II principles, and then we rolled it out over all the entities, even though they weren't potentially big enough to handle it. And death by governance is probably the way they feel. Okay, so the impact of the internal model on our ORSA, just two more slides, is that we were forced to take a phased approach to embedding the ORSA. And I won't read all of it, but just taking capital as example, we lost the battle. You have to focus on the capital. You have to focus on the numbers coming out. Then in phase two, you can think about meaningful risk appetite limits and tolerance limits, really getting down to a more granular level, splitting it down to segments, looking at products, etc. And only in phase three are you going to come to meaningful capital allocation, which are really giving you return on capital that's demonstrating a risk-based decision-making and an integrated business plan. And you can do the same for risk and value. And then I think the use framework is probably the one that had the most impact on our development of our framework and our approach. I mean, we had already in place the risk strategy process, the risk appetite, risk identification processes. We had a quantification process, and we were changing the methodology. This monitoring and mitigation had to expand. It was much more focused or centric on ops risk management, and we needed to find a way of communicating other risks. And crucially for us is getting this stress and scenario testing its own piece of the pie, so that you have both elements coming together, the model, number crunching, and the wider guys, the guys who sit and think, what's the impact on the business? And finally, the feed into business strategy. And the way this eventually materialized was in very detailed business planning packs that were submitted by all the business plans, all the business units that have identified risks already in the plan, that they've tried to project capital according to their initiatives for the year. And then around the sides, everything that you've learned during the year about embedding in your business. So wherever you've made a product development decision or a pricing decision, or you've made a treasury type decision on an acquisition, that you record that, that you evidence that for the ORSA process. And that's why for us it's no longer become really an issue of timing of the ORSA report, because this happens all the time, and the board will see it. If it's material, the board will see it. And what you're trying to do is once a year in a report demonstrate everywhere where you've made a risk-based decision. And maybe a final point is we place a strong emphasis on this feedback loop thing, because without it, it doesn't really matter. You know, so we need to get the risk guys, the CROs in all the business units, talking to the actuaries saying, we see this, you know, as part of that channel. How does this affect your assumptions? And we're nowhere near there, but that's the idea, is to start fostering that cross-functional talking between people about risk. I think that brings to a close our sessional meeting. Any questions for me?
Yeah. Right, Jill, well, your hand clapping preempted. Just wanted to say thank you for Klaas and Karen. And Klaas, I think you got the lion's share of the questions there. and I think you've got something to report back through the ORSA task group and to the FSB that clearly, if you look at the number of people in the room, that the industry is taking the ORSA seriously. And for those of you who thought you were just coming for some CPD points, maybe you've realized now that you've perhaps learned something that's not, you know, more than just CPD. It's of real value. So once again, thank you very much for your contribution. Speaking of taking things seriously, Old Mutual also takes our attendance here seriously, so I believe there's some really nice snacks and drinks to have afterwards. And thank you for coming.